All right, I'm here. It's Gary Parrish again. This is the Eye on College Basketball podcast again. And I'm talking to you on the morning of November 25th, although I don't guess it's technically the morning yet. It's actually just really late on Sunday in most people's minds, although it's technically Monday. Either way, here's the point. I'm in Connecticut after spending 2 days here at the Hall of Fame tip-off. Jeff Borzello is back home. Matt Norlander is at home, and they are both joining me now on this edition of the podcast. Fellas, how are you at this advanced hour in the night?
We're podcasting after dark. I'm amped up about it.
I know
it
is. Yeah, I'm loving this, man. This is you're on Gottlieb time right now. Back when we did podcasts, we were doing it well after 1 Eastern. So it's good, man, and a wild weekend, right?
It was a wild weekend. I was obviously here at the Mohegan Sun for the Hall of Fame tip-off, and it's funny, like when I landed here, I guess it was late Friday night, I was like, yeah, why am I here? You know, I mean, it's going to be fine, I guess, but we're not even sure if North Carolina is going to beat Richmond, and then if they have to play Louisville. If they do beat Richmond, they're going to play Louisville, get run off the court. This isn't probably an ideal place for me to spend the weekend, or it certainly doesn't project as what we thought it might be in the preseason. And then, of course, what happened Sunday, North Carolina didn't only beat Louisville, they handled them pretty easily, especially in the second half. And so I wrote a column basically saying, you know what, maybe we buried North Carolina a little too quickly and sort of expanded to make a larger point about, you know, this is sort of one of the neat things about college basketball. You can lose to Belmont on one Sunday and beat a Louisville on the following Sunday, and neither one of those things are really going to determine absolutely your future. It's just part of a larger puzzle, but still a remarkable victory for Roy Williams, and he's been doing this a long time. He has multiple championships, but you got to think this is one of the more satisfying November wins he's ever had, right, Borzello?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at it, it looks – I mean, I was actually at the National Prep Showcase, which is in New Haven, Connecticut, I guess like 40 minutes from where you were. People are like, oh, why don't you drive up for UNC Louisville? And I was like, I don't want to see a 25-point blowout. I could watch that on TV anywhere. And, you know, you look at – I watched it on the computer while I was there, and you looked at the lineups Roy Williams was using, and he's probably never used them before. He had, like, McAdoo at small forward. He had Bryce Johnson. He had Kennedy Meeks. You know, that was a huge front court that usually you would say, you know, Louisville's just going to press them, and they're going to force turnovers, and those big guys won't be able to keep up. But Roy Williams is like, no, we're going to grab every rebound. They were going to beat them down the court, and they did that. I mean, Marcus Page looked like an All-American. Kennedy Meeks looked like Kevin Love with his outlet passes, and you know, it was a really, really good coaching game from Roy Williams.
And how about that? Because he's a guy, listen, let's be honest. We did that poll over the summer, I guess it was 2 summers ago, and one of the questions was asking for the most overrated coach in America, and Roy Williams won it, or lost it, however you want to phrase that. I don't know if it was by a significant margin. I honestly don't remember, but I do remember that, you know, that was something that he had to read and then had to talk about, because the local media in Chapel Hill and in the Raleigh area, like, asked him about that specifically. And, you know, it's weird to think of a guy who's won 2 championships as, quote, overrated. We typically think of a guy who hasn't won championships but is considered a Hall of Famer as overrated. And yet people don't, for whatever reason, take him seriously as a basketball coach, and yet you know, he was up against somebody everybody takes seriously today in Rick Pitino, and it went okay for Roy.
Is the Pitino, I mean, GP, I kind of want your take here, since you were sitting press row and you watched this. Was this game, in your opinion, an aberration on behalf of either team? I mean, how did Pitino take it afterward? Because this one, It's weird to say North Carolina beating Louisville could be so stunning, but given what North Carolina had, and with no McDonald and with no Harrison, and with, you know, even before this game happened, you wrote about how there's no end in sight for that saga. We don't know if PJ Harrison is going to play for Carolina at all this year. So did it feel like a one-off, or do we genuinely believe that Carolina right now, I mean, the top 25-1 for everyone listening, if you haven't seen it yet, Parrish has got UNC at 11 now, and Louisville at 12. So what were your just in general impressions of this game and whether Louisville just had a fluky bad day or if Carolina really has that kind of potential?
Well, Louisville definitely had a bad day. And I refuse to believe that Rick, who's a Hall of Fame coach, as long as he's got an All-American guard in Russ Smith, a really talented guy in Chris Jones, and then, you know, Montrez is a future pro. I mean, they've got a good team. I mean, like, the idea that Louisville's just, you know, they're talented, they're experienced, they're coached by a Hall of Famer, they're going to be fine, you know. But this, you know, what happened on Sunday was, I don't know if it was an anomaly, but it was bad. I mean, it looked bad up close. I mean, they were, you know, Carolina was dominating them in the front court. Carolina was leaking out and abusing the press. Russ Smith and Chris Jones were taking all of the shots. And though that might not be the worst thing in the world, considering those might be their two most talented scorers, it didn't work well in this game. In other words, Louisville looked awful, and Rick was upset, and the players looked like they were walking out of a funeral. When they were walking out of the Mohegan Sun, but I think they'll be fine. The interesting thing to me is North Carolina, because I don't know what to make of them right now. I'm still not sold that they're even, you know, the 11th best team in the country, which is where I have them ranked right now. And because I know this is going to come up, I'll go ahead and try to explain that now. I know that this sounds stupid to a lot of people because they go, Jesus, they're just rankings. Why do you care? But I take this stuff seriously. Like, I think about it a lot. And I put a lot, you know, you might not agree with my logic. I mean, like, you guys might not agree with my logic. And other people I recognize aren't going to agree with my logic. But I put thought into it. Like, I can explain to you why I do everything I do, even if it might not make sense to somebody else. And essentially with Carolina, I just decided, look, where did I have them in the preseason? I had them 11. And where did I think they'd be after five games? I thought they'd be 4-1 after five games, and that's what they are right now. Now, they got to this record in a different way than I thought, but at this point, they have a bad loss, the home loss to Belmont, and they have a great win. And so Louisville, meantime, is sitting here with no good wins and a loss on a neutral to Carolina. So I said, why not just throw Carolina back in at 11, throw Louisville right behind them at 12, and then move on. Again, I recognize that everybody's going to agree with that, but it at least makes sense in my head as I was putting it together. But so what is Carolina? I'm not real sure, because there's still some fundamental flaws with that roster without PJ Harrison and Leslie McDonald. And if they play the big lineup, they are almost certainly going to have just one ball handler on the court in Marcus Page. If they, and at all times, they probably only have one shooter on the court or a guy who can even take three-pointers in Marcus Page. I don't think McAdoo's very good on the wing. I don't know if Kennedy Meeks can consistently give them what he gave them to, you know, in the finals of the Hall of Fame tip-off. But still, they won the game. And even though they are shorthanded and sort of a weird roster in terms of the way it's put up, you know, all those guys that are playing for them, for the most part, major minutes are highly recruited McDonald's All-American caliber guys. And so I'm not really sure. I think the truth is probably somewhere in the middle. They're not somebody who's going to be able to beat a Louisville on a neutral court consistently, but probably also not somebody that's going to lose to the Belmonts at home either. I think the truth is probably somewhere in the middle.
Right. I think that, like, this game says more about UNC than does Louisville, just because, like, Blackshear's not going to go scoreless every game. Rozier's not going to go scoreless. Right. Montrezl Harrell's not going to foul out. Like, but for UNC, I think it gives their young guys confidence, and it gives Marcus Page confidence. Because, like you said, I mean, these guys are highly recruited. It's not like he's molding these three-star slobs, you know, into a juggernaut. Like, Kennedy Meeks was a really good high school player. I think this gives him confidence. You know, the biggest question with him is conditioning. Can he give 20 minutes every game? You know, that remains to be seen. But Marcus Page, he can be a go-to scorer now. And I think that the Tar Heels, they're looking at, you know, James McAdoo only scored 9 points, and we scored 93 and beat Louisville. And I think it gives kind of their role players and their young guys, you know, maybe a little bit of extra boost heading forward that, you know, they can carry this team if their stars are having an off night.
What do you think, Nolander?
Well, that's fair, but I want to talk Duke now. Okay, I got questions just in general. I got questions genuinely, and then I got questions maybe we can set up to help listeners kind of understand what you're doing here, because you got Duke 4. I mean, what in the name of Taylor Coppenrath happened in Durham tonight? I mean, Krzyzewski and Duke edge out Vermont, a 1-5 Vermont team, and I grew up 2 miles from that campus. 91-90, Duke barely wins. In a lot of ways, you could say they were actually lucky. Krzyzewski said they were awful. called Vermont terrific. Rodney Hood said it was terrible. Doesn't even feel like a win. Duke is now 5-1. They were dangerously close to having a loss that would have been, in my opinion, five times as worse as what UNC had last week against Belmont. But you still got them at number four. Thoughts on or your well, kind of your process
well,
on that?
For, well, quickly, why would this be worse than Belmont? I mean, Vermont's probably the favorite to win the America East.
I think they're still a much worse team than Belmont. And are you sure they're the favorite in the America East? Were they picking they're like top two or top three? They're not awful, but they were 1-4 entering in, and yeah, they don't nearly have the firepower.
That's cute that you guys are debating the American East.
Hey, don't be downplaying my Catamounts, man.
Here's what I would say. You know, I know how much Norlander buys into KenPom. And I do too. Like, I'm looking at it right now. Vermont woke up today. They were 196 at KenPom. I mean, this would have been like a bad, bad home loss for Duke. The truth is, I don't typically, particularly early in the season, punish people for bad wins. You know, I'll punish you for losses, for good losses, for bad. I won't punish you for good losses typically, but I'll punish you for bad losses. But I don't typically punish you for wins. There is not I don't know. I'm not looking at it right now. I don't want to make a definitive statement. I'm just saying at some point, all good teams, even great teams, struggle with somebody they shouldn't struggle with. If it hasn't happened to somebody yet, you know, Michigan State, didn't they do it the other night? When was, you know, a couple nights ago?
They had a couple. Yeah. They had a couple of games.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah. You're good. So like good teams, even great teams, particularly early, are going to typically struggle at some point. I don't know if Duke is really the fourth best team in the country right now, but I had them there on Sunday morning, and so after a win, I didn't see any real reason to drop them. Wins are wins, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and
what I will do is I'll pay attention to patterns, and if you are consistently struggling with bad teams, like, you know, 4 out of 6 or 5 out of 8. Like, if you consistently struggle with inferior opponents, then maybe it's time to, maybe it's time to reevaluate what you are. But, you know, and I know Duke struggled a little bit with East Carolina, and this would be 2 in a row with Vermont. But, you know, I'll pay attention to what they do next, but I don't typically punish people for winning.
By the way, Duke hasn't dropped a non-conference home game since 2000 against St. John's. In a way, they're almost weirdly due. Granted, most of the teams they play home non-conference aren't that good, but that's a crazy schedule. One more thing on the rankings here, GP. So you still have Michigan in and kind of comfortably in. They did lose last second to Charlotte Sunday on a buzzer beater situation. Charlotte, you don't have in. You kind of addressed that in the post. Plenty of people would say, you know, what you did here picking North Carolina had a Louisville 11-12 situation. You could have done that with Charlotte, Michigan, but you opted not to.
Yeah, here would be my reasoning. And I swear to God, like, I put so much thought into this stuff. Like, I can always answer the question. Now, I might answer it and then you'll go, well, that's stupid. But I at least got an answer for you where I know there's a lot of AP voters. When you ask them, so why'd you do this? They go, I don't know. I just threw it together at the last minute on Monday morning. You know, like, I at least have a reason behind everything I'm doing. The reason would be this. I think fundamentally in November and even into early December that preseason expectations matter. That I what I thought you were going to be still lingers. In other words, I didn't think Charlotte was going to be very good. And I did think Michigan was going to be very good. Now, I don't think that makes me unique. I don't think most people thought Charlotte would be very good. And I do think most people thought Michigan would be really good. And so I asked teams to, if I didn't think you were going to be good, win your way in. And if I did think you were going to be good, lose your way out in a pretty convincing way. And so Michigan's sitting here with 2 losses, obviously. One was at Iowa State. Well, like, everybody's going to lose at Iowa State, outside of maybe like Kansas, right? You know, people are going to lose there. I'm not really interested in – I don't think that tells me Michigan's not a very good team losing at Iowa State. Now, the Charlotte loss on a neutral, that's troubling, right? But again, it was at the buzzer. They did just beat Florida State. Florida State seems to be pretty good at this point. So basically, I'm giving a team – that doesn't have an awful resume at this point, although, again, they got this what would be considered a bad loss on a neutral court. They were a 10-point favorite in that game to Charlotte. It did come at the buzzer. I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt based off of what I thought they were going to be in the preseason. Charlotte, on the other hand, you know, they do have a loss to Charleston. I think it's Charleston, you know, earlier this year. I don't think you can just disregard that because they won a few games in this tournament. Beyond that, I don't know how good they are. Like, I do know that they beat Michigan at the buzzer. You know, I saw it. You know, I was watching it. But I don't know how good they really are. The metrics don't really like them. KenPom doesn't really like them. And so I will ask Charlotte to prove it to me over a little bit more extended period of time. Despite the fact, in other words, despite Sunday's result, I'll give Michigan the benefit of the doubt because I think they're good. And the all the advanced statistics suggest they're good. And I'll make Charlotte prove it a little more, because I didn't think they were good in the preseason, and the advanced statistics don't suggest they are.
Okay, are you worried about Michigan at all? Because I think that
I'm really no joke. I think they got serious issues.
Well,
big time.
I think the biggest issue is I mean, they're the guys like McGarry and Glenn Robinson. They just basically lived off Trey Burke and Tim Hardaway last year, taking attention away from them, and now they're kind of being relied on to be go-to guys, and I think they're really struggling. And they're kind of not being exposed early on, but you know, I guess yeah, they're being exposed early on that they're not really being able to get their own shot consistently, and I think that's a huge, I guess, detriment to them right now.
I don't know if baby big dog Glenn Robinson, like, he's a really talented player. He's going to be drafted. I think he is a future pro. I don't know to what level he'll have success there, but at this point, to me, he seems like he's best suited as a reliable role player in the highest respect that you could use that term. I just don't know if he's an alpha yet. I don't know if, like, Tim Hardaway wanted the moment. He wanted the shot. He embraced it. Sometimes it was to Michigan's detriment over the course of his career there, but a lot of other times he really took that on, and him and Burke really paired well last year. Now there's obviously a point guard situation where they're trying to replace Burke, which they won't do in a year, and nowhere even close to that. But can Robinson really be the guy to lead the team from a standpoint of what he needs to do? Because McGarry obviously can be the team's best player and be very good at this back issue, won't hold him back too much. But it's very hard for college basketball teams over the past 20, 30 years to find tremendous amounts of success with a guy like McGarry clearly being the go-to guy in every respect. I feel like Robinson has to step in and be that, and he hasn't shown that yet. And overall, Michigan just doesn't seem like the pieces are there right now. I would say they're not top 25 good, just me personally.
Well, they did beat Florida State the other day. They are trying to replace not just their point guard. Like, we say this all the time, like, you know, Louisville's got to replace a point guard. Well, Louisville's got to replace Peyton Siva. You know, that, and with all due respect to Peyton Siva, he ain't Trey Burke. You know, Michigan's having to replace the national player of the year and also Hardaway. I acknowledge that we could look up in another 2 weeks or 2 months and go, wow, Burke made all of those guys so much better and made everything for Michigan so much easier. And they're really just not, you know, a top 25 caliber team without Trey Burke. And like, listen, when the polls come out on Monday, if Michigan's unranked, I'm not going to, you know, write a column saying it's stupid, you can't unrank Michigan. I just think at this point, I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt. This is a conversation we probably wouldn't be having if, you know, a one shot went in on one end or one shot didn't go in on the other end. Then they don't lose to Charlotte and they're sitting here with the record that is very, very reasonable and probably still has them in the top 15. Let me tell you this, though. Here's the team I am concerned about. VCU.
Mm.
What's going on with VCU? Because it's one thing to get to lose to Florida State if we think Florida State's pretty good. It's another thing to get run off the court. Then they struggle with Long Beach State. Then they lose to Georgetown. This is a team that, despite a early loss to Virginia, they don't look good, and they haven't played well. Yeah, go ahead.
To me, the scary thing is, like, you know, people are saying, oh, well, maybe they're not forcing turnovers. Maybe the fouls are getting to them. Like, they're forcing turnovers just as hot, you know, as well as they were a year ago. Georgetown had 26 turnovers today. It's not translating like it did last year. And I think, you know, that experience they had, I'm completely blanking on the point guard's name from last year. But I think he's been missed a lot more than we thought. His numbers weren't
atheists.
Yeah, Darius Theus. I think his numbers weren't you know, astronomical. But I think just like Trey Burke in Michigan, they're missing him a lot more than maybe some people thought they were. I mean, Bronte Weber is fine, but he's not the leader. He's not, you know, the guy that can get them under control and get a bucket when things are going tough. And I think that they're having a harder time replacing him than people thought they would be.
I thought Theus going and Daniels going would have an impact on VCU. I'm blindly lucky right now. I picked UMass to win the league and VCU to be second. That's probably not going to happen, but UMass looks really good.
How
VCU
about
is,
UMass?
Yes, 6-0.
Loving UMass, totally. They're deserving of all the love they're getting. Chaz Williams might be him and Shabazz. Shabazz had 7 turnovers. I saw him in person Friday night, and he can kind of frustrate you just a little bit, and he's a poor man's Kemba in a really good way. But the point is, Chaz and Shabazz are so much fun. For VCU, I had questions with how the offense would flow with this year, you know, on a much lower level in terms of the point guard situation, like we talked with Michigan. That's a totally different situation. But, yeah, there's legitimate reason to be concerned because, GP, it's not – what's crazy is the new points of emphasis have not really affected VCU all that much. Now, maybe Shaka believes otherwise. We haven't really seen him quoted on that. But they're, as Borzella said, turnover rate and just number of steals per game is still very high. So they're efficient there. Offensively, though, they're just not near what they were a year ago.
I'm glad you brought up UMass, though. And by the way, that pick does look pretty solid right now. They are 6-0. They won. What event were they in? The Charleston Classic? Was that it? They beat Clemson. Clemson was also undefeated in the championship game. And I'm thinking about maybe writing a column on this for Tuesday. I've known Derek Kellogg for a long, long time, obviously, because you know, he was an assistant under John Calipari when I was the beat writer covering that program at Memphis. And it's been, I guess, not an easy transition to him for being a head coach. I mean, he went 12-18 his first year. He's gone through 5 years and never made the NCAA tournament. And typically, with programs that matter, if you go 5 years without making the NCAA tournament, you don't always get a sixth. In fact, if you go 4, you don't always get a fifth. And you know, I've talked to Derek about this over the summer, just in, you know, at these summer events, and you guys know how they are. You just end up sitting next to people, and one day or night, I don't remember when, and I don't even remember what city we were in, but I end up sitting with Derek, and we're just sort of talking, and because I live in Memphis, he brings up Memphis, and he said, "How's Josh doing?" Talking about Josh Pastner, and so we talked about that for a while. And he said, "You know what? I don't." He said, "Josh doesn't realize, and because, or at least I don't. This is what he said. I don't think he realizes that you learn as you go when you're doing this. Because when you're in your first year, you think you know exactly what you're doing, and you get in your second year, and you go, 'Oh God, I didn't know what I was doing in my first.' And you get to your third, and you go, 'Oh, I can't believe I thought I knew what I was doing in my second.'" And he said, "You look up," and he said, "I don't think I really became comfortable." This is Derek Kellogg talking. Until last year, which was his fifth year as a head coach. Like, I think I finally have a good idea about you know, how I want to play and who I am and how I coach. And he was talking about this in context of, you know, Josh Pastner getting more and more comfortable at Memphis. But as you look up now, you know, maybe it highlights the need for patience with some programs and some fan bases and some athletic directors, because you know, I don't know if he was ever on the hot seat. I mean, he's an alum, so they would be more patient with him than other places might be. But certainly the record hasn't been great through 5 years, but it looks like this sixth year might genuinely be a breakthrough. Barring a huge surprise, UMass is going to be ranked in the AP and coaches poll on Monday for the first time in a long time.
I want to know where Carmelo Travieso and Edgar Padilla are right now, because listen, to me, I don't know, maybe Borzello is kind of the same way. Maybe you too, GP. I mean, we're not too far apart. I think what Borzello and GP have, what, 8 years, maybe 10 years between them. But the point is, in the 90s, when Calipari was at UMass.
I was going to say, I don't know how old everyone is, Matt.
In the 90s, when
you don't have to point out how much older I am than Borzello. You don't think that bothers me enough?
Yeah, you don't think that bothers
me? You're only like a solid, what, 35 years old? You're plenty healthy.
I'm 36, but earlier.
I'm gonna be 27 on Friday. That's gonna be late 20s. My life's over.
Well, then happy early birthday.
Dude. Yeah, here's the problem. I'm already feeling a little depressed about this. I was at a blackjack table earlier, not because I wanted to gamble, but because I wanted to watch two different basketball games at the exact same time, and they had the TV set up in the pit where you could watch
exactly where we were.
You could watch Michigan Charlotte on one and Clemson UMass on the other. So I was actually working, technically working. If anybody asked, I was working. And so so this guy sitting next to me, and he just chit-chatting and whatever. And he goes, so he's like, where are you from? What do you do? And so we're talking. We're having that that normal blackjack conversation. And he goes, yeah. He goes, so I'm just being kind. I ask him what he does, and like I care. And we end up, and he goes,
he could be listening to this, man.
Oh yeah. Oh well, I did care on some level. I did. I don't know. Whatever. Here's the point. He goes, yeah. Well, you're a lot older than I am. I said something that made him say, yeah. Well, you're a lot older than I am. And I said, really? How old are you? And he said, 35. I'm like, God, because he's a 35-year-old who just assumes I'm a lot older than him. And really, he thinks I'm 50 probably sitting there. And it's my gray hair. I need to do something.
Oh, I mean,
about
listen, GP.
It's just your maturity level.
You're so mature. Well, it's that, but you go hard. I mean, you've got a story for everything. So that's also part of it.
Oh, here's a story. Let me tell you a story real quick while we're on casino stories. You ready for this one? So I'm in the poker room on late Saturday night after watching, let's be clear, three straight basketball games on Saturday. I said, you know what? I'm going to go to the poker room, watch some football, play No Limit Hold'em. And so I'm sitting in there, and I don't know if you guys have ever been in a poker room or if you play poker, but most poker rooms of significant size have what they call a bad beat progressive jackpot, which basically means if you take a bad beat or if anybody at your table takes a bad beat, your table wins the jackpot. What that means is if you have at least four fives and you lose a hand, then the back beat jackpot has been hit, and the person who loses the hand gets – I think 50% of it. The person who wins the hand gets 25% of it, and the other players at the table split the rest of it. So I'm sitting there playing a poker on Saturday night, and just we're watching football. It sounds like a poker room, like you hear chips and you hear people talking, but it's nothing loud or crazy about it. And suddenly this guy jumps out of his chair screaming, and it like startles me. He's literally sitting right behind me at the table right next to me. I don't know what's going on, because it could be like a 20-50 table where people are paying big money, and maybe he raked a pot on the river for a few thousand dollars or whatever. I don't know what's going on. Turns out he and his wife are both playing. It's a $1 game, which means it's the cheapest game they've got in the poker room. Everybody sitting there has like 50 bucks in front of them, 75 bucks in front of them. His wife had quad fives. She lost the hand to quad eights. They hit the backbeat jackpot for $301,000.
What?
$301,000. His wife, who lost the hand with four fives, she walked with $150,000. The other dude that won the hand got $75,000, and the other people at the table split the rest, which came to about $10,000 a piece. In other words,
that family got $160,000.
Yes. These people who came, and bless their hearts, they came to the casino with like 50 bucks, 100 bucks to just mess around with, right? They walked out, like this lady walked out with $150,000. I've never, like, they were, people were crying at the table. Like, it was unbelievable. Like, in all the online poker I used to play back when it wasn't so difficult to play online poker, and like all the poker rooms I've been in I have never seen I've never seen a jackpot hit, a bad beat jackpot hit like that. And well, like, these people went bananas. Like, I've never seen anything like just normal people with normal, very normal live according, and not even serious players, or at least not serious gamblers, all walked out of there like in a terrific mood. It was a wild thing to see. How about this? So you only get paid on it if you're seated at the table and you're dealt into the hand. There was one dude who got up to go to the bathroom and missed it. Can you imagine?
Gosh.
Oh no.
That's brutal story in his back. How did you fare, by the way?
I was fine in the poker room, and then I was walking out, and Mohegan Sun is weird. There's like a million different casinos at Mohegan Sun, right? So as I was walking out, I don't even know where my parking garage is. I'm just trying to find my parking garage, just sort of aimlessly walking. And there's like this, they put this club like it's almost like right in the middle of the casino. Like people are in there dancing and they got all this stuff going. And so, and there was loud music, and I said, okay, cool. I'll play a couple hands of blackjack and watch this, you know, because you can sort of sit at the table and watch people.
That'd be creepy, man.
I know, it was very creepy, right? And so my old ass just sitting around just creeping on the kids at the club. And so I say, all right, I'll play. And then I lost money playing blackjack that night. But how about this? Here's another one for you. So I sit down at this table, and they've got these, they hire these girls, and whoever's in charge of this, bless their hearts, because it's just something I think everybody enjoys. They hire these girls to, like, basically dance. They're just there to stand on stuff and dance, right? And so they're just so these girls are just standing on the table and dancing, and like dancing as hard as you've ever danced in your life, right? And so I'm like, I'm playing blackjack, and I'm watching. I don't mean to be watching, but like it's hard not to notice them. And so so this old man, like there's this old, I don't want to say old man because hell, he's probably,
he could have been your age.
I know,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Probably my age, right? So, but an older gentleman, and he's there with what appears to be his wife, and we are the only three people at the table. So it's this man and his wife and me, and he goes, you know, focused on game. And I'm like, what do you mean I'm not? What do you mean I'm no focus on game? He said, you focus on girl. You not focused on game. I'm like, well, he goes, you looking at her. I was like, dude, everybody's looking at her. She's dancing 7 feet from us, you know, like half naked. Like everybody's looking at her. And he goes, do you like her? And I'm like, what do you mean? Do I like her? He's like, do you like her? I said, I think everybody likes her. Yeah, I think that's why she's hired to be here, because people like her. He goes, you. $500 for 1 hour. I said, are you in charge of selling the girls? Like, how does that work exactly? And he goes,
how does this happen to parents?
I'm sitting there. He goes, $500 for 1 hour. And I said, are you being serious? I don't know if you're being serious. You seem serious. You seem like a serious person, but I can't tell if you're being serious right now. He said, $500, 1 hour. I said, listen, I'm not going to buy her, but can I talk to you as a friend? Can I talk to you as a friend real quick? He said, sure. I said, she is worth way more than $500 per hour. Like you are way undercharged. You have undervalued that girl. So
what would you in theory?
I wouldn't is the correct answer. I'm just saying at 2:30 in the morning at a $50 a hand blackjack table,
four figures.
You can get four figures for that. I don't know about. Yeah. You can get four figures for that girl for an hour. Pretty good. So anyway, the dancer pay scale at Mohegan Sun confuses me, but the Bad Beat Jackpot was awesome to witness. And now I think we've been talking for 12 minutes.
We are certainly venturing into new territory in this podcast history.
soliciting people.
Oh my gosh. At some point I was talking about UMass basketball in the mid 90s.
How about UMass basketball? Derek Kellogg?
My point in shortly, my point was that UMass basketball was awesome and relevant growing up in the 90s. It was one of the things that really made me love and enjoy the sport. So it's been.
They were in the movie
so,
The Sixth Man.
That's right, man. So they've been so irrelevant for so long. It feels really good to see this program finally, because the fan base has been waiting for a breakthrough year. And, you know, it looks like this is going to be that year where they should be a no bones about an NCAA tournament team. So it's really great to see that. But I did want to be selfish here and bring up something that I ran into Saturday night. I saw Michigan State beat Oklahoma. They're 6-0 for the first time since actually 2000-2001. Some crazy stats. I mean, I didn't realize when Michigan State got the number one ranking recently, only the third time ever in program history. And you would have thought sometime in the past 13 years, Michigan State would have had a 6-0 start to a season, but they obviously scheduled tough in the non-conference.
Sure.
Anyway, point is, they win the game, they beat Oklahoma. Oklahoma got out into an early lead, and then Michigan State went on an amazing run to end the half. Then the second half was continually like Oklahoma played them well. Michigan State held them off, you know, 5-7, 9-point differentials. They win. Izzo just like walks off the court, and he's just roaring mad. I mean, just really mad, and you're kind of like, you know, what's going on here? Well, point is, eventually he met with a few of us media members outside the locker room after, and Izzo, guys, I mean, he's just, first of all, he's the best. I mean, he really is the best about saying stuff on the record that is really insightful, useful, passionate, and he just gets it so much. So he basically spent about 10 minutes talking about why he already thinks the system in place with the points of emphasis with officiating is broken. Because basically his point is foul shots are going to go up. We're going to see an uptick in scoring average, but it's going to be primarily because of foul shots. And more than anything, he knows coaches will do anything to win, and he's going to do it. And if he's going to do it, he thinks most coaches will. And it's basically going to be, let's take our best dribble penetrator in a close game, close situation, just fling him into the paint because you know you're going to draw a foul, and that's what it's going to turn into. It's going to be foul fest at the end of the game with even more free throws, and that's what he's worried about. I mean, he said he told Keith Appling, he's like, Keith, if you shoot a jump shot, I'll kill you. You're driving to the hoop, and sure enough, there were two critical possessions for Michigan State near the end where Oklahoma was really threatening. Appling was able to draw contact both times. One was an and one, and Michigan State got the win. So it was just really interesting to see Izzo in victory with a number one ranked team just take so much time to say, hey, listen, in my opinion, this does not forebode well for the future of college basketball. I don't know if it's an overreaction on Izzo's part, but it definitely, this isn't something that I think he just, it came to him in the second half. I almost think he wanted to wait a few games, see what else happened around the country, and he's come to this. And I think he's got some valid points, but I'll also mention that, you know, I think there's a human element to the officiating, and we could get to December and January where some of this might balance out.
Yeah, do you buy all that? Like, listen, Tom,
I think it's already balancing out.
Yeah, I think it's already balancing out, too. Listen, let's be clear. Tom knows more about basketball than any of us, all three of us combined, right? And he's terrific because he will talk about things mostly openly, whether it's most times on the record, sometimes off. But he, sometimes you feel like when you ask a coach something about a particular player or a particular team, you never know if they're shooting you straight on it, or at least you have to figure out who shoots you straight and who doesn't. Tom, like I feel like I could call Tom and ask him honestly about his team, and he would tell me honestly what they are. Like, what if he thinks they're great, he'll say they're great. Hey, we're really good. Or if he thinks they're bad, he'll say, hey, you know, we're not as good as people think. And, you know, and it'll show at some point. He's remarkably honest in that way. And also, what I like about him is that he's somebody, and I don't know if he did this with you guys the other night, he seems genuinely interested in what you think about something. Like, he typically wants to know your opinion about something too. Like, I can just remember when I spent those days with them in July a few summers ago, where he and I, like, spent 3 days together in a private plane and private in cars on, you know, hotel lobbies at games. I was with him for every moment of every day, unless we were sleeping in separate hotel rooms. I was with Tom, and so we had a lot of time to just chit chat. And after a while, you run out of things to say, you know, about, like, so, you know, how's Keith Appling going to be? You know, like, you run out of those conversations pretty quickly. And so we would end up talking about things, and he would have these big, important opinions about issues within the sport. But then he would always say, "What do you think?" Or "How would you have handled this?" There was the that 1 year, I think, where he had to dismiss Corey Lucius, or he let Corey Lucius train, however that went down. You know, he explained to me the details behind that, and he said, okay, now what would you have done? You know, what would you have said? How would you have handled that if you were me? You know, when the Cleveland Cavs job came up, you know, he's like, okay, now what would you have done? What should I have done differently? And so I like the idea that he seems genuinely, and I guess he did maybe do this to some degree with you guys the other night. He wants to know what you guys think about this as well, right?
He does. I mean, he asked our thoughts. He asked the crazy thing was, he's like, guys, who's behind this? You know, it ain't me, and it ain't a lot of coaches in power that I know. It was the coaches committee that oversaw this, that passed this through. There's almost this weird, who's behind the curtain tugging the strings here with this points of emphasis. So he did come back at us. But Borzella, you don't think it's a little overblown? Because I kind of lean that way, but Izzo was so, like, convincing that it made me double think it.
There's been games where, yeah, it's clearly noticeable. I mean, games are taking 2.5 hours and people are shooting 100 free throws and whatever, but there's also been a lot of games where it's pretty normal. And I just think, you know, like he said, that people are just going to tell their guards to drive the lane and throw something up. Like, I mean, refs aren't going to call fouls that aren't there, and it's easier to just, I mean, I could just say go play better defense. But, I mean, I think that, you know, you could have said the same thing about the NBA when they cleaned it up, but, like, it's I mean, the NBA is awesome to watch now. It's higher scoring, it's faster paced. Like, I think that's what Kyle DeBresle's going to become. I know right now the scores are higher because of foul shots, but I mean, I just think that, I mean, the fears that Kyle DeBresle is going to go way downhill because fouls are going to be called on everything, it's not going to happen. I just think it's kind of like a paranoid fear to have right now.
You know what I think happens? Here's what I think happens. I think that everybody now, first off, I don't think the casual basketball fan knew anything about the quote new rules until like right before the season started, these scrimmages. Agreed. And then we helped create the narrative by talking about it or tweeting about it so much. So now what happens is, let's say there's 10 relevant games on a day, right? Let's say there were 10 relevant games today. I bet you most of them were played and they looked completely normal in the way that they were officiated and the number of fouls and the number of free throws, whatever. But if you, for every time you get one high profile game or nationally relevant game that goes long and that has 60 fouls, then that's the one everybody screams about and focuses on. Like, you know, so I guess this Michigan State game was what, Saturday night, right?
Yeah.
Well, like, okay, so what happened in the other game Saturday night? Like, what about the other game Saturday? You know, did any of them have it, you know, go 2.5 hours? We don't even know. In fact, I'm betting you know, because if so, we would have heard about them too. And so I think we've sort of got into a pattern of we sit back and we let these games happen, and then if one really gets a lot of fouls or one, you know, goes 2 hours and 28 minutes, then we focus on that and hold it up as an example of how the new rules are really making basketball bad. But I don't think that's the norm. Obviously, there are more fouls calls. There should be. That's the point. Yeah. But I don't think – I still do not, with all due respect to Tom Izzo, I still don't think this is the problem that some people are making out to be. And even if it is right now, I'm in the corner that whatever growing pains have to come with this, I'm willing to deal with them to get a better product down the line, which I think this will help do.
I also don't think we're getting a terrible product while we're going through this little phase either. I mean, I'm with you. I don't think it's overblown.
Right. Well, there was the night the other night when, you know, I didn't hear a single person talking about fouls or the new rules on the night Marcus Smart went for 39 and Jahi Carson went for 40.
Right.
And I think McDermott.
Kaminsky.
Oh yeah, Frank Kaminsky was the other one. I was trying to give it to McDermott.
Some other white guy. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, the different white dude went out and got what did he get?
42.
Yeah. 43. So, yeah. So like, I don't remember that being I don't remember all this stuff being you know, where was that conversation last Tuesday night? It didn't exist. And so, I get it. You know, we're all going to watch games this week and it'll pop up again. But yeah, I think we're only screaming about it so loudly every time it pops up. I don't think it's really affecting the sport at large the way maybe some people think it is.
Yeah, you're just saying we're naturally hypersensitive to the issue. I totally agree. I'm expecting kind of like a 2 to 3 year period where we might have some of this, but it's all relative. And I agree with Borzello. I think a lot of these games aren't actually all that bad. We do have some, and I also think there are plenty. I do want to be fair. Like, I think there are games that aren't televised or we don't know about that might have, you know, 42 fouls and take 2.5 hours.
Right.
We don't know because they're on TV. I think there's a little bit of that. But Izzo being the first, like, you know, you could say there are, what, 10 to 12 really major college coaches in college basketball. Izzo being the first one to really come out on this. You know, Eustachy's been a critic since the beginning, but Larry Eustachy isn't a household name. Izzo being the one to be so definitive on this, it will be interesting to see if and when, like, Self's been a little critical. When will he say something? If he will, Krzyzewski, Roy Williams. Patino, I think, said he's okay with it right now, which is a little surprising given the way that his team plays. So, certainly valid on the other side. This is, I understand.
Orlando, why you got to take shots at coaches every week? Last week, you took Rick Bird over Calipari. This week, you're saying Larry Eustachy's not relevant.
That's not what I'm saying, dude. I'm saying being a household name.
I think you're taking shots at coaches every week.
That Rick Bird thing, top 5 coach in America, was terrific. I was hoping you'd drop another one of those this week. I was hoping. The Rick Bird top 5 coach in America was awesome.
Can we be a top 10? Come on. Top 10. I'll stand up for top 10.
And Larry Eustachy's not relevant enough.
Okay. No, okay. Good. 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 Good.
Name.
Good. Norlander.
No, not a household name. Don't be doing this.
Okay. Norlander. This is good. Top 10. Okay. I want you. I'm going to name 10 guys, and I want you to take one of them off the list.
Before you do this, Pete. Before you do this, we need to be exact in the description. I think Rick Bird is a top 10 X and O's coach in the game. That doesn't include rooting. Okay, it's all relative to it.
Well, we could go find high school coaches who are great X and O guys, but what does that matter?
If whoever made a dribble drive, you can probably make your top 10.
All right, here we go, Norlanda. You ready? Tom Izzo, Bill Self, Rick Pitino, John Calipari, Sean Miller, Mike Krzyzewski, Jim Boeheim, Billy Donovan, Roy Williams, and I need one more. How about I go Thad Matta? Those are 10. Who are you taking off to replace him with Rick Bird?
I'm taking John Calipari.
You did it again. I love it when you do this.
And hold on, real quick though,
Number one X Calipari with Rick Bird.
No, guys, seriously, number one X and O guy. Who do you think it is in all of college basketball? Number one X and O guy.
I don't know.
Well, I think it used to be Rick Majerus.
No, you know what? It was Bob Knight. It was Bob Knight, or Brad Stevens might have been that, or he was up there.
No, I think Izzo. It might be. I don't know. It might be Izzo.
I think Majerus was up there.
I don't know. I find that kind of stuff fascinating just because Paris has talked about this. I know we're kind of going off on a tangent. We should wrap up. But like a lot of it seems to me like a lot of the old school way of coaching in terms of X and O's is somewhat dwindling just because of the culture of college hoops. And less and less, it seems like that kind of style is in vogue and seen as a way to win, whereas it's more who can you recruit, can you get the best athletes on the floor, and then you kind of take it from there instead of the other way around.
To me, it's interesting that the teams that play kind of like a slower pace, their coaches are usually more renowned for X's. Like Bo Ryan is, people say, I'm not, and obviously he's a great coach, but because his teams don't score more than 60 points, he's renowned as a great X's and O's guy.
You want to know what the truth is? Here's the truth. Most people who sit around commenting on guys who can and cannot coach don't know anything about coaching. They don't know. They don't have any idea what's going on a basketball court. Like most people who sit around, like it's so frustrating to me. Like, and sometimes I think it just becomes like this groupthink thing. Like, I'll see random people who have nothing to do with the Baylor basketball program. Like nothing. They don't know anything about Baylor. They're not close to Baylor. They don't watch Baylor. But then Baylor will be on television, and Baylor will two Baylor players in a row will take bad shots, and they'll go, oh, God, Scott Drew can't coach. And, like, I'm not even arguing right now whether or not Scott Drew can coach. I'm completely uninterested in the conversation. I'm just saying that somehow this becomes a narrative in, like, these little circles, and then people just use it nonsense. Whereas you can watch a Wisconsin team, and two guys will take bad shots, too. But nobody will ever conclude from that Bo Ryan can't coach. Where I always fall back on is, okay, fine. Since I brought up Scott Drew, let's talk about Scott Drew. I don't know whether he can coach or not. Okay, whatever. I'll let other people debate that. I know this. He's a successful coach. I don't know if he's a good coach. He's a successful coach, though. He's been a 2 Elite 8 at Baylor, which is insane. I just think of people in those terms. I'll never forget in 2008, we had a national championship game between John Calipari and Bill Self, and it was billed on some level as a title game between two guys who are just recruiters but can't coach.
Right, ridiculous, yeah.
Which is absolutely Obviously ridiculous. And yet now, how about Billy Donovan? Remember when he, quote, couldn't coach? All he could do is recruit players, but he couldn't coach them? Well, now nobody says Billy Donovan can't coach. So I think some of this stuff just it comes and goes, and it's often, I don't want to say always, but it's often rooted in nothing at all other than that you just made up your mind one day.
Suddenly, when you win games, you're a good coach. Like it's basically what it eventually boils down to.
Well, you know what? Here's actually what it boils down to, I think, because I don't think it's that simple. Because like Roy Williams,
that's true. We talked about this 50 minutes ago.
Yeah, almost nobody's won more games than Roy Williams, right? I mean, he's won two national championships. He's almost never missed the NCAA tournament. Like he is great. If you just take his resume, like he is off the charts. And yet, here's what I think: to be called a quote great coach, it's almost like you have to be a bad recruiter.
Right. Yeah. Yep. I was just thinking that. Like, because if you don't have good players, you're suddenly a great coach.
You have to have bad players before people will respect you as a good coach, because then you have to be able to win with guys who aren't as good as somebody else's guys. Then people go, man, he can really coach. But you know what happens when I look at guys who have bad players? I think they're a shitty coach, because I'm like that's, you should have better players.
Like recruiting's a huge part of coaching.
It's the most important part. So I get so frustrated when people are like, you know, people will always ask me, or they'll say things like, well, I don't even know who it'd be, but let's just say they go, you have to respect so and so. Nobody does more with less. Well, I don't want a guy who does more with less. I want a guy who does more with more.
Go get more.
Yeah, I want a guy who does more with more. Like I the idea that your whole philosophy in coaching college basketball would be doing more with less means you are missing the point wildly. And so I do think that sometimes, you know, the guys we call great quote coaches, they're guys who aren't great recruiters. Like, you know, but the truth is, you know, John Calipari is a great basketball coach. Bill Self's a great basketball coach. You know, Mike Krzyzewski is a great basketball coach. They're also, you know, and when you can find the guys who are great recruiters and quality, you know, actual coaches on a, as you put it, dry erase board or whiteboard, Norlander, then you got Hall of Famers. And that's how they become Hall of Famers. But I think sometimes the idea, like if you, you know, like Majerus. Oh, Majerus was great, and he was great. Nobody would dispute that. But if he'd have recruited like Calipari, would you have ever even got to the point to where you'd have called him great, or would you have just discounted him on some level by saying, oh, well, all he does is get players and just win with talented guys? I think that's on some level what Roy Williams runs into.
Agreed. Hey, this was an awesome podcast, guys.
Do you think? It's awful long. I think we set a record here.
Yeah, it's like 50
we did, and
minutes,
it's, I'm not even delirious. We're almost at 2 a.m. I'm still wired from the weekend. And that crazy football game, you know, which
podcast
we put on.
Yeah, we could do an entire podcast separately on whether or not you should take the wind in overtime.
Take the wind. That's why sports are amazing. We'll never have to worry about taking the wind in at the games
we
cover.
If we play a game on a ship again.
Yeah.
You know what?
Hey, Norlander, you're speaking as a man who's never covered a game on a ship. I was there for Carolina, Michigan State, and it was freezing. I remember three things about that ship.
You got lost.
Oh, God.
Remember that.
It took me 4 hours to get on the damn ship, which was like I almost missed the game. But what I remember is like, okay, there's Barack and Michelle. That's pretty cool. And then I remember like just sitting there as the sun was setting and going, man, this is beautiful. Like, this is one of the most beautiful like scenes you could ever have. Arguably the most beautiful scene you've ever had, period, for a basketball game. And then I remember going, Jesus Christ, it is cold. It is so cold on this. I've never been that cold covering a basketball game in my life. It was freezing once the sun went down. But you're right. We have basically touched the hour mark. So let's wrap this up. And let me wrap it up by telling you guys, thanks for doing this. Not only for doing it, because I know on some level you're obligated to, but for doing it at this time of night, because I got to get up in just a few hours and drive to Hartford and then fly to Atlanta and then fly home to Memphis. So trying to do it early in the morning would have just been difficult for everybody. So thanks to you guys, and thanks to everybody who's listening on CBSSports.com, reading what we write, interacting with us on Twitter. Remember, you can subscribe to the Ion College Basketball Podcast. You can do that on iTunes. So make sure that you do that. It's free. And either way, I'll talk to you later on this week. Take care.
Happy Thanksgiving, JP.
Yeah, you too. You too. You too.
What about me?
Yeah, happy right, Thanksgiving to you too, Borzella.
You too, Borzella.
And my birthday.
I'm great. Actually going to spend. I'm going to be Thanksgiving in Orlando. I'm going to be in Orlando for the Old Spice on Thanksgiving. So I will wake up. How about this for Wednesday night? I'm going to see Yeezy. Going to see the Yeezus tour. Going to see the Yeezus tour on Wednesday night. Yeezy season approaching on Wednesday night in Nashville. And then I will wake up on Thursday morning, fly from Nashville to Orlando for the Old Spice Classic. So I will not have a traditional Thanksgiving, but it will be an interesting one, I think.
That is great. You guys have a great Thanksgiving. Borzello, happy 30th. And we'll talk.
Whoa.
I'll see you guys later. Go. Bye. Good night.